In the days of the ancients, the Son of God was conceived by some miracle and was born. In those days, the ruler of the land was terrible and was threatened by the newly born would-be king. And so, he attempted to have the child murdered, unsuccessfully. The Savior is eventually betrayed and killed, but by divine intervention, he is resurrected, giving hope to all of humanity. The Son of God will engage his ancient enemy, remove the enemy's power, and ultimately triumph and ascend to the throne. He will establish his reign of divine order and peace. You probably think I'm talking about Jesus of Nazareth, and you would be wrong. I just described the story of Horus, Osiris, and Set, gods of Egypt. There are a lot of atheists and other critics out there that claim that the figure of Jesus is just the Egyptian god Horus retold. And after looking at the Horus myths, though, the viewpoint is embarrassingly limited, as you will see today. And yet, there are definite similarities, thematically at the very least. It makes sense given the influences the Egyptian Empire had on the ancient world. If people took inspiration from Egypt and wove them into their stories, and those stories eventually became the stories for the Christian Savior, I wonder, what do the Egyptians offer that influenced the formation of the Christian devil? You're about to find out. Welcome to the Ancient Origins of the Devil, Egypt. This is The Devil You Don't Know. Hello, everyone. I'm Don Early.
I am Emily Kwan.
I'm Jeremy.
And this is The Devil You Don't Know, the podcast that explores the historical and cultural relevance of the devil. And today we begin a multi-part series on the ancient origins of the devil.
Finally!
Yay! My little history nerd heart is exploding.
Yes. And today, in specifically, we are going to cover ancient Egypt. So I'm very excited about that. I wish I could play the Bangles, Walk Like an Egyptian.
But you just put it in everyone's head. Everyone that knows.
Yeah. Everyone who's listening is providing their own background music for
this. No, you got it.
Unless they're Generation Z and they're like, what's a bangle?
Yeah. YouTube it. It's there. Okay, so, well, anyway, I said this is a multi-part. So what are the other parts? So it's going to be ancient origins blank. So upcoming on the docket, I've got Mesopotamia and Canaan, Zoroastrianism, ancient Greece, early Judaism, and of course, early Christianity. And we may do a couple more in there as we come through it. And don't worry, we will cover Hindu and Buddhism in more detail. I just haven't done the research and I don't know where to fit it yet, but it's coming. They may be standalone episodes. We'll see.
Cool.
So, and once again, you can get all of our resources, links, show notes on our link tree, which you will find in the description of this and every episode. And that is all I have for the housekeeping today.
And then, so are we talking about Ma'at and Isfet today?
No. We will talk about Ma'at or Ma'at, okay, or however, but the other one doesn't come up.
The absence of order doesn't come up?
I didn't know there was a name for it.
I thought Ma'at was like the order of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm pronouncing it wrong. Isfet, I thought, something like that, was just the absence of it. Kind of like cold is just the absence of heat, right?
Sure.
So that stays. So I thought that, like, if we were talking about the beginnings of the devil, then like, or the beginnings of evil. And so many times evil is considered chaos. Then yep. I thought that might be where that started. And so
we'll
I thought that,
talk about
that, that dualism, you got the order of the universe and then the absence of the order of the universe, which
or
would be
the disruption,
the chaotic state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah,
we will talk about that process for sure.
Perfect. Let's get going.
All right.
I'm waiting so much.
I know. I've been waiting for chair. These episodes. Ancient Origins. Let's do it. Come on.
Okay. Well, I don't want to keep you waiting. So we have two questions we're trying to answer today. What was ancient Egypt's version of the devil? And how did this set up elements that influenced later incarnations of the devil? So those are the two things that we're going to be kind of exploring. And if you are following along, what I'm about to talk to you about, the sources are, of course, the Jeffrey Burton Russell book, The Devil, pages 78 to 84. We're also, I'm not going to be bashful, Wikipedia, worldhistory.org, Britannica.com, you know, Google searches, man.
It's they get what you get, man.
Yeah.
I like it.
I mean, this is background info, so I guarantee you, you will learn something you didn't know about ancient Egypt today. Hopefully it's true.
Fingers crossed.
Okay. Well, one of the coolest things about ancient Egypt is that it is one of, if not the civilization that we have the earliest written record of. That may not be true, that we may have that in the Assyrian Empire and went on up in Mesopotamia. I know they can go back to like 4000 BCE, but we definitely in Egypt, I mean, they were definitely there at that time as well. So the Egyptian civilization, as it began, gathered and thrived in the Nile River Valley, as you probably have guessed. Each year, the Nile flooded, renewing the fertility of the soil for farming. And the sun rose every day and set every day. And there was just these constant cycles that they could count on. And it provided stability and things like that. And this, you know, so the sun and the water and these cycles of weather, they worshiped them. You know, they become very, very central to their understandings. And so they observe the world as this orderly, balanced, and cyclical way of being. Water and sun were life. Time happened in cycles. You know, it would go through one cycle and then it would start again. I mean, if you think about an annual flood, right?
Right.
Like the flood happens and then everything after the flood and blah, blah, blah. And then, oh, the flood is, we know the flood is coming, that sort of thing. So they observe the world as ordered and balanced. What were you going to say?
I was just thinking about the idea that if you have this destructive flood that comes on a regular basis, like you can annually count on it. Like I can see a lot of power in that kind of belief of the, even the life and death cycle of the fact that there is going to be this cataclysmic flooding, this destruction of these things because new birth comes out of that. Like that just kind of jives real well because it's not a surprise. They know it's a part of it.
Mm-hmm. And so, of course, when that order and when that cycle is disrupted, it's real bad because they're counting on this. And so it just causes havoc. So if there is a low flood level, that can mean famine for that time period. If there is a great flood, it floods far more than they expected it, then that would destroy all the crops and stuff. And then on top of that, of course, we're talking about Egypt. A harsh, scorching desert surrounded the Nile Valley on all sides. And the people inhabiting that desert were seen as barbaric enemies of order. The valley represented stability that had to be protected against the chaotic surroundings. So order, chaos, renewal becomes this cyclical theme, right? And obviously chaos is real bad. It's because that disrupts life and that sort of thing. So the stability, the natural order of things is called Maat or Maat, the divine order of the cosmos.
Wow.
Yeah. And of course, Maat becomes a god as well, in an actual god form, but it is also a phenomenon. It is a principle. The cosmos is ordered and it is a divine balance. And when it is disrupted, then by chaos, evil is a disruption of Maat. And so when Maat is disrupted, it must be restored.
Sure, right? Because it was the break of the cycle and therefore the reestablishing. I get it.
So their myths, you can imagine, are full of that. In 3600 BCE, the Egyptians were focused on farming and raising domestic animals. But shortly after that, though, civilization began to advance at a faster pace towards refined civilization. Until by the time around 3100, so another 500 years BCE, Egypt becomes unified under one king, the pharaoh Menes. This is known as the start of the early dynastic period with the first dynasty. And so what I mean by that is that the Nile Valley, it was kind of split into two. There's the upper, which happens to be in the south, and the lower, which happens to be in the north. Of course, you know, the Nile flows north.
Flows south to north, right?
South to north, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But anyway, water flows downhill, so.
Breaking my North American brain.
It does. Okay, so upper south Egypt united with the lower north. And it is thought that around this time, that of course they had myths that explained the cosmos and whatnot, but now they were being brought together, adapted and repurposed and organized into, you know, kind of an organized religion or a cohesion of the stories, right? To reflect the new divine order of things, right? Civilization under one king, the pharaoh.
The pharaoh, one king, one god.
Yeah. But of course, Egypt plays a pretty big part in the biblical contexts, right? The Exodus and the Pharaoh, let my people go, and, you know, Moses and all that stuff. So, you know, I guess listeners at home, if you're not familiar with those, just go watch the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston.
I don't know if that's as good as Wikipedia.
It's not very, but it's what a lot of people think of. You know.
There was, what else? There's that Prince of Egypt.
Yes, I was going to say the animated movie, which has some of the most fantastic music in it.
Good point.
Gorgeous soundtrack.
Anyway, obviously Egypt plays a real big part in early Judaism and the Torah, which is the first five books
of the Bible,
of the Old Testament. And so Exodus would be the second, Genesis being the first. So it's estimated, so I went on a hunt here. When did the Exodus happen? When did this, you know, event occur? So obviously...
Good luck with that.
The Exodus really isn't the stories are not meant to be a historical accounting of things. They're mythic, and they're meant to be that way. They tell a truth and a story, but... they were based on something. They had to be based on some kind of an occurrence. And so scholars kind of estimate that the peoples and events that the Exodus stories are in the Abrahamic scriptures are based on occurred somewhere between the 1500s BCE to the 1200s BCE. Some will put it a little bit backwards. There's a lot of disagreement over exactly when, but I think just to put in some context, we're just going to kind of say it's roughly right in that mid 1500 or, you know, the 1500s to 200s. I mean, and so 300 year range, probably closer to 400 right. year range.
I watched a fantastic documentary about that. And I, for the life of me, I cannot remember the name of it. And I might have to grab my phone and look it up while we're doing this and chime in later, because it's going to drive me nuts. But it was fantastic. They used historical writings to try to figure out what similarities are there between historical writings and the biblical writings. Mm-hmm. And scholars put it here. But if we move the timeline like 500 years this way, a few more things line up with it. And it was fascinating to get kind of what things were actually happening in the world at this time that these lessons in Exodus were kind of taken from.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna, excuse me.
You'll find it. We'll post the link in our link tree as well.
Okay. Yes.
For that. I'm just going to read the entry from Wikipedia here on the sort of biblical context about the Jewish exodus from Egypt, you know, that story mm-hmm. of the exodus. This kind of gives us some information around that. Quote, despite the absence of any archaeological evidence, a majority of scholars agree that the exodus probably has some historical basis, with Kenton Sparks referring to it as mythologized history. Scholars posit that a small group of people of Egyptian origin may have joined the early Israelites and then contributed their own Egyptian Exodus story to all of Israel. William G. Dever cautiously identifies this group with the tribe of Joseph, while Richard Elliot Friedman identifies it with the tribe of Levi. Most scholars who accept the historical core of the Exodus date this instead dating to the 12th century BCE at the time of Ramses III. Evidence in favor of historical traditions forming a background to the Exodus myth include the documented movements of small groups of ancient Semitic-speaking peoples into and out of Egypt during the 18th dynasty, which is right around 1479 to 1458 BCE, and then 19th.
There was evidence of that. You started with no archaeological evidence, but that one had some evidence of small tribes moving.
Yeah. So let me go back. Most scholars who accept a historical core of the Exodus date this possible Exodus group to the 13th century BCE at the time of Ramses II, with some instead dating it to the 12th century BCE at the time of Ramses III. Evidence in favor of historical traditions forming a background to the Exodus myth include the documented movements of small groups of ancient Semitic peoples into and out of Egypt during two different dynasties. So the 18th dynasty, which was 1479 to 1458 BCE, and the 19th dynasty, which was 1292 to 1189 BCE. Some elements of Egyptian folklore and culture in the Exodus narrative and the names Moses, Aaron, and Phinehas, seem to have been Egyptian in origin. That is interesting.
Yeah.
Scholarly estimates for how many people could have been involved in such an Exodus range from a few hundred to a few thousand. Just a little bit of background information to set the stage, because our concept of the devil is built upon Judaism, which is, you know, and Christianity is built upon Judaism and
right.
so on and so forth. So,
these myths and the timelines that we had with them are about that same time frame. They're earlier.
They're way earlier.
Way earlier. Okay.
Yeah. So well, most of the myths. Oh, yeah.
Sorry. I read it was like 2500 BC.
Yeah. So a full 1,000 years before then.
Yeah. These stories
probably even before then.
They're varied. They have different versions depending on your location or, you know, who they revered, you know, in that time or in that place. But these stories were present.
Got it.
And okay. They were coalesced in like the pyramid texts and when the Upper and Lower Egypt were united. That happened a couple of times. They would unite, and then after a while, they'd break up and be mad at each other, and then they unite again. And
okay,
like kingdoms do.
So during the time that we think that Exodus may or may not have happened, these myths have still been around for a full 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Wow, that's really old.
So now that we have some ideas here about a little bit of the beginnings of ancient Egypt, let's get into some of the myths here. And it's always great to start with the creation myth. So Emily, why don't you take on the Egyptian creation myth?
Sure, happy to. So this dates back to, it looks like 2780 to 2250 BCE. In the beginning, there was only the dark, formless waters of the void that swirled and churned without purpose. Existing within this void was the god of magic, Heka, who awaited the creation of the universe. Out of the watery silence arose a hill with the great god Atum standing upon it.
Now, I'm going to pause you there. So Atum, the main big thing here is that he is the self-created god. He sort of manifested spontaneously, created himself out of creation. And the other thing to note is that Atum is also Ra. Ra is the same god, different form.
Like,
I mean, these gods take different forms.
Atum Ra.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Atum Ra, you know, there is Khepri Ra, which is Atum's brother. And then there is, I think there's one more, but essentially Khepri is the morning or the dawning sun. Ra is the midday sun and Atum is the setting sun, but it's all Ra.
Okay. So Atum is standing upon a hill. That's where we left off. All right. He looked around, sensing his aloneness, and so with the power of magic, he mates with his own shadow to give birth to twins.
Wow.
Right.
That's... Normally that would sound weird, but since you told me that he just created himself, like he made himself out of being, of course, mating with your own shadow is not an issue.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, wow.
Because he created that too.
Yeah, this guy can do anything. Okay, so here are the twins. Shu, the god of air, whom Atum spat out, and Tefnut, goddess of moisture, whom he vomited out. Shu, god of air, gave the early world the principles of life, and Tefnut, goddess of moisture, gave the principles of order. The two new gods left their father on the hill to go out to set up the world. After a while, Atum got lonely and missed his children. So he removes his eye and sends it to find them, like you do.
Is that a common practice? Removing your eye? Sending it on its own?
I mean, when I lose my children.
Wait a minute, hang on. So that's the Eye of Ra? It's Autumn's eye that he sent out?
It's one of those. There's also Eye of Horus. There's a whole like mythology around. Egyptians have this fascination or this, you know, morbid obsession with eyes and plucking your eyes and then getting your eyesight back. And I don't know what it is, but.
I mean, in all fairness, I would say that comes up in a lot of other religions as well. I know the eyes are the window to the soul, and that's a common phrase. But they take it really, really literally here, taking out his own eye.
Yeah. So he plucks out his eye and sends it forth to find his kids.
Yep. I mean, how else would you find them, right? Shu and Tefnut return with his eye. Nice.
So does that, I'm sorry, does that... Is that where we get keep an eye on them?
Oh, man. I hope not. That would be weird.
Keep an eye out. All right. Wow. Shu and Tefnut return with his eye, and he's so overjoyed at seeing his children's safe return that he sheds tears of joy, which dropped onto the dark, fertile earth of the hill and gave birth to men and women.
Nice. Okay,
hey, Dad, we found your eye.
But, like, that same eye... That's tears of the eye. That's now people.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, well, it impregnated the world, or the earth, which then birthed humanity.
Oh, got it. So it wasn't the tears that gave birth, the earth did. Right. Okay, check.
Humanity didn't have a place to live yet, so Shu and Tefnut mated and gave birth to Geb, god of earth, and Nut, goddess of sky. Geb and Nut, brother and sister, fell in love with each other, but Autumn found this unacceptable. So Grandpa separates them, pushing Nut away from Geb, high up into the heavens. The two lovers could see each other, but never touch. Nut was already pregnant, though, and gave birth to Osiris, Isis, Set, Nephthys, and Horus the Elder.
Very pregnant.
Yeah.
That's five gods.
Yeah.
And actually, in a lot of the stories, I shouldn't say most because they're all different. But a lot of the stories, it's only four. They leave out Horus the Elder. Horus the Elder is equated with Osiris. Okay. It's just a synonym quite a bit. So
maybe it was only four.
Could be four, but some of them include this other brother called Horus the Elder.
Horus the Elder. Okay. So
yeah.
It's interesting.
Pregnant with four or five kids.
Yeah.
So Shu is the god of air, but Nut is the god of sky. Mm-hmm. Shep's daughter, or Shu's daughter. Okay.
Notice also that the earth is a male god and the sky is a female god.
Yeah.
Where in a lot of mythology, mm-hmm. it's mother earth and mm-hmm. father sky. Here it's reversed.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
It's a wild kind of seeing of creation, though. That's mm-hmm. that is very different than any other thing I've heard.
Well, we're going to see more of Osiris, Isis, Set, and Nephthys, and AKA, and also Horus in a bit. Now let's talk about Sekhmet. We have another goddess that has two forms. So Hathor is goddess of joy. She, in some stories, is Ra's daughter. In others, she is Ra's wife. Maybe it's the same in both. I don't know. That was kind of a normal thing in those stories, it seems to be.
Sure.
Hathor also has been called the loving mother and nurse of Horus the Elder. So again, that comes out again. And, you know, these gods have just different roles and they can kind of be switched or swapped out for other gods. Hathor gets associated with Isis later on as well. So they kind of become synonymous. But Hathor, goddess of joy, she's kind of a fertility goddess. Well, she can take the form of Sekhmet, who is a goddess of war and fierce and bestial. She has like the head of a lioness.
Sweet.
And Ra has these three guardians called the Eyes of Ra, who are all goddesses that have some kind of bestial. I think one of them has a face of a head of a cat. I guess lioness is a cat, but
yep,
more of a house cat.
more cat-like.
So they served as Ra's scorching eye upon humanity. They defended
that eye again.
Yeah, they defended the gods from the sins of humanity, or they were also the gods' vengeance upon
sure.
humanity.
Yeah, that makes sense, right?
Yeah. So here's a myth about that. This is Sekhmet. Ra created humanity happy, good, and in harmony with their creator. But when Ra got old, humanity rebelled, plotted against him, and then turn and cut and run into the forest, into the wilderness in fear. So Ra's courtiers said to him, "Send forth thine eye, that it may slay them for thee." And so Sekhmet goes out into the wilderness and slews the shit out of mankind in the desert. She wades in human blood and exalts in death.
Whoa.
Sekhmet becomes the goddess of war, battle, and cruelty.
Wow.
So really, really into it.
Yeah, she loves her job. Her bloodlust at this point, though, greatly disturbs Ra. So in order to prevent her from entirely wiping out all of civilization and the, you know, all of humanity, he sends his servants out to fetch red dye and mix it in with 7,000 jars of beer.
That's a very large and specific number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
7,000.
7,000 jars of beer. And then they pour the beer out on the road, on the path in front of Sekhmet, which she mistakes for this, you know, swath of blood. And she laps it all up, getting shit-faced, and stops destroying everything. So
that's awesome.
Wow.
Cow beer saved the world. Again.
Well, the beer I will drink tonight will be in her honor then.
Why? You know, so is this, so I'm just thinking of this particular myth, going back to the devil concept of, so we just saw the creation myth. This is like the saving of humanity before they were all destroyed.
Yeah.
From this destructive creator, this destructive Sekhmet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of like, humanity is sinning against the god or the gods, and so they're being wicked, and so he sends forth this destructive force to, you know, correct the matter.
Yeah.
But determines that maybe he's overcorrecting. And to me, this reminds me of like the story of Noah and the flood.
Right. I was just thinking that I was originally going to like Sodom and Gomorrah, but yeah, really of the preserving some sort of humanity from everyone being wiped out, like the flood story.
Yeah. It's a fall myth of some kind. And I think that's the whole point of putting this in this episode, is that it sets up, you know, the fall and fall myths that we get later with Lucifer and so on. So
gotcha. Okay.
All right.
Crazy. Wow. That's a good one. You know, it was funny when you were reading through and talking about how she relished in her job and became the goddess of war and death and cruelty. I started picturing Hela from Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah.
Like with a freaking cat face. And I was like, that's probably a fit. And that's what was happening in my head. Just like killing everything and laughing all about it and wading in blood.
Yeah.
So yeah, badass. That's great. I'm going to picture that next. This next one is the big one. We're going to set up the myth of Set and Horus. And Osiris is going to be involved with this. And Horus and Osiris are going to get confused for each other a lot. So,
okay,
bear with me.
Hold your breath.
Okay, so Horus the Elder is a sky god. Osiris is a god of fertility, afterlife, resurrection, agriculture. Set is a god of chaos and war and storms. Isis is a fertility goddess, and she's associated with rebirth. She is the sister and consort to Osiris. And Nephthys, goddess of mourning, as in you are in mourning of someone who died, mourning.
Gotcha.
The dead, not death, but the dead, darkness. She is sister and consort to Set. Okay, so that's our five. And we mentioned those earlier.
Okay.
So we get these myths as ancient as the pyramid text. So this is 2400 to 1650 BCE. And hostility between these two gods, Set and Horus, grows over time until by the Hellenistic period, 323 BCE to 31 BCE. 31, obviously, we're getting a lot closer to the time of Jesus.
Yeah.
But this is also 31. This is also, we're talking about Julius Caesar and Mark Antony.
Sure.
For context, Mark Antony and Cleopatra were happening around 34 BCE to 31 BCE, where Antony, of course, famously died in 31 BCE.
Right.
So, a little bit of context there. And as I said, Horus the Elder is going to get used interchangeably with Osiris. So
be ready for it.
Yeah. All right. So some scholars think, or they say that this myth is political. So they set Horus as the god of Lower Egypt, the one in the north, and Set the god of Upper Egypt in the south. Okay. But others say that it's a god of opposite ecologies. So Horus is the god of the black earth fertilizing Nile, and Set is the god of the dry, scorching desert. Get this. Red was the evil color, as it was the hue of the hostile, scorching sands of the desert. And because of Set's association with the desert, his color is commonly red. And red-haired people are said to be of his own in some special way.
Oh,
wow. Dear.
So, yeah. Sorry, gingers.
Curse on the gingers.
As time goes on, red and black are associated with the Christian devil. And in the Middle Ages, you know, ruddy people, gingers, were considered proper sacrifices to the devil. The association with Set is likely the origin of this.
Wow. So sacrificing people, giving them back to him.
Egypt,
yeah, basically.
Egypt's one of the few cultures where black is not the color of evil, but instead it's the color of the fertile, life-giving plains of the Nile Delta. So black
the
is
rich,
a very
dark soil.
Life-giving. Yeah. So black is a life-giving. Red is harshness and sand and evil. Okay, so doublets, we've talked about God with opposite manifestations as separate gods. Set and Horus the Elder, they're brothers. Set and Osiris are brothers. Horus the Younger is, I haven't mentioned him yet, but we have a, you know, we have Horus the Elder, we're going to have Horus the Younger. Horus the Younger is the son of Osiris and Isis, so okay. He's Set's nephew. But ultimately, Set is one half of the deity with Horus / Osiris. They are often worshipped together and sometimes represented as a two-headed god. It is not uncommon to see Horus referred to as Set and Osiris's brother, and then in the same text, he is referred to as Set's nephew and Osiris's son. Set and Horus come into conflict, and since that is a disruption of Ma'at, the conflict must be resolved. Set, mostly evil, is in conflict with Horus, Osiris, mostly good, and so sets out, to destroy his adversary rather than seeking union and harmony. So he does the opposite of what is needed to bring balance back. So Set doesn't quite get the way to do this. So so here's the myth. This is the myth that we get a lot of our devil stuff from.
Okay.
Meaning that, you know, this is Egypt's sort of devil story. So Jeremy, why don't you take this one away?
Cool. Yeah, I'll do that. This is the Set's Horus Osiris myth, right? So this is the one that was actually used as a model for Pharaoh. See if you can follow the pattern for this one. Osiris was the firstborn son of Geb, who, if you recall, was the god of earth that we just talked about earlier, and Nut, the goddess of the sky. So this is the firstborn of the two, or Nut, I think is how you pronounce it, right, Emily?
I pronounced it Nut, but I think it can go either way.
It's too late. It's Nut now. It's on the internet. That's how it is. Permanent.
I have decreed that this is how we shall pronounce this word. Okay.
So Osiris was their firstborn, and he ruled over the two kingdoms, earth and sky, with Isis, who is his wife and also sister, because they gave birth to her too. So Osiris and Isis are together right now. Set grew jealous of his brother Osiris and devises a plan. He tricks Osiris into getting into a chest and then locks him inside, which, by the way, totally has happened. I absolutely locked my sister in the dryer when we were like 3 years old and 2 years old. I told her it was going to be a spaceship and she'd have fun, and she couldn't get back out. So like, I know that that happens.
Oh my God.
A real thing.
Yeah.
She got out, by the way. She's fine. She got out.
Okay.
Well, that's good.
The mom in me is like starting to like.
Yeah, my mom had some words too.
Well, so the inside scoop on this is that Set decides to throw a party for Osiris, and he brings a gift of this coffin, this beautiful ornate coffin. And he says, I will give this coffin to whoever this coffin fits the best. And Osiris goes, well, I'm going to give that one a shot. You know, it's my birthday or my party. Let me see if this will fit me. And then, of course, slams the top of the coffin. The like, ha ha.
He wins. In. All right, cool. All right. So the locked chest that Osiris is now in, the coffin, gets thrown into the Nile, where it sinks, and then Osiris drowns. Dead god. So... yeah, so now Set is the big god because Osiris, the oldest of all of them, is gone. So he gets to take over the throne because patriarchy. So now Set rules over two kingdoms with his wife and sister, Nephthys. So remember, there was the two sisters. There's Isis and there's Nephthys. Set married Nephthys. So now they're ruling over both of their kingdoms. But remember, there is still Isis. Isis, Osiris' wife's sister, now stricken with grief at the loss of her husband brother, goes on a search for her husband's body. She ends up recovering the body and brings it back to Egypt. And now she gets to work her magic. She goes to gather herbs, she makes potions so that she can bring her husband back to life. And she enlists her sister, the other queen Nephthys, to watch over him. All right, so meanwhile, Set starts to clue in that Isis may have found Osiris's body. So he also goes to Nephthys and questions her. She lies to him because she's rad, trying to be a good sister, but he sees right through it because he knows lies pretty well. Eventually, she gives up the location of Osiris' body that they found. Set then goes to the body, tears into the coffin that he made, and literally dismembers Osiris into 42 or 14 pieces, depending on which story you're listening to, and then scatters those pieces all over the face of the earth. So locking him up and drowning him was not enough. When Isis returns, because she was out gathering those herbs, she finds the coffin's destroyed and that her husband's body is gone. So again, she is full of grief. She weeps and she despairs. And Nephthys feels horrible for totally giving up where he was and betraying her sister. And then she tells Isis what happened. So she also tries to help recover those pieces of Osiris because she should. She totally made that happen.
Did Isis ever get back at Nephthys?
Oh, I'm not done. Let's find out.
Okay.
So what happens is both Isis and Nephthys go and recover the pieces, most of them at least, and assemble all the body parts, except for the penis, importantly, because that was eaten by a fish. let's be clear. Any dude who is ever swimming in the ocean naked is always afraid of that exact thing happening. We're just convinced that's what's going first. So proving us right.
Wicked worm.
Isn't there a fish that actually like swims up into it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's not in the ocean, I think, but there in the Amazon, I think that thing exists.
Okay. At least I've heard that before. Like
I have not experienced it. So I got to check the internet. I don't know the fact of that one. But that apparently is what happened to Osiris. So we got all the pieces except for one. So here's what happens next. The stories get a little conflicting in the details, but it's kind of an immaculate conception story either way. In one version, Isis creates a makeshift penis for Osiris and revives him enough to conceive a son. So that worked.
Oh.
She gives birth to Horus the Younger using the fake dong. In another version, Horus was...
I'm sorry.
Let's pause for laughter.
I'm sorry. I'm 12. I'm 12. Okay.
In the other version, Horus was conceived without sex. He just became. They willed him into existence. Or he was begotten by Osiris while he was still dead, kind of depending on how you read it. So either Osiris
gave... Boring.
No penis, don't care. So in either case, whether or not it was the magic dong or something else, Osiris gets revived. All the pieces are put back together and they did bring him back to life. Apparently dickless. He doesn't feel like ruling the two kingdoms anymore. I don't blame him. It did not work out for him in the first place. So feeling a little emo, he sets up his shop in the underworld. So now, regardless, it's a resurrection story. So he came back to life and is like, you know what? F this. I'm going to the other place. And so he's now... So Osiris is now the god of the underworld at this point.
Yeah. So, and part of the story that kind of gets left out here is this is where mummification gets invented. In the process of resurrecting him, she gets help from Thoth, the god of knowledge, and who instructs her on how to do this. And so she mummifies Osiris, and that's why he's being, you know, he's able to be resurrected, which provides a model for humanity.
Gotcha.
That is super cool.
That's really interesting. Yeah, for the body parts and the wrapping up that way. That's cool. Going through, just to kind of get to the end of the story here, this quote said Osiris had to die that he might live and that his resurrection might give hope to mankind. In a particular quote, even though killing Osiris was a necessary act, Set is not seen as having done something virtuous with it, right? Like, it turned into a thing that worked out, but at the whole time at the start, Set was being a dick, right? It was a trick, and then it was a full-on cursed attack for all of that.
Yeah.
And there's a comparison here with Judas and Jesus kind of being the same way, right? Like, Judas had to betray Jesus, but still got the bad rap for it. So, I don't see anything where Isis got revenge on Set, so it had to fall to the kid.
No, on Nephthys. Kid.
Set and Nephthys.
For giving him up.
Sister's blood is way too strong. Nope, no revenge there. But there's got to be revenge on the killing, right? So now Horus the Younger, that's the one who was born from the magic dong, or immaculately without it. he now is the adversary of Set, and so now it's a head-to-head. With Uncle Set, who is the evil uncle. Set tries to murder Horus the Younger as a baby and fails. And when Horus grows up, he gathers a great host, which is a whole big army, to battle against his ancient enemy for the throne of Earth. In the end, the two meet in Mortal Kombat, as is should happen with every major god battle, and they mutilate each other. Horus totally castrates Seth, depriving him of his power. Because the dick is power, everybody. Keep that in mind. According to the Egyptians. Oh, I see the eye roll. Okay. maybe not as much. Fish thinks it's power, so let's just go with that. and just to make sure that we're keeping it all the same, Set tears out Horus's what? That's right, his eye. And then burns it.
Buries
Horus, it. By the way, was in the form of a black pig at the time, so... That's why I could get to it easier. I don't know. I don't know why that made it a thing. But yeah, so they like completely tearing each other apart physically. The conflict was perceived as kind of a conflict of opposites, right? So in that Mortal Kombat form, it's perceived as the heaven versus earth, or fertility versus sterility, life versus death, and like earth and the underworld. But never, interestingly enough, a good versus evil. I would have immediately said Horus is good and Set is evil. But that's very much my Western upbringing with that. But that's not the way it's perceived or brought up inside the myths.
Hmm. Yeah. So even Set has been like Ra's protector. So, you know, Ra has that cycle where he goes through the day, but at night he has to go through the underworld and he falls asleep. And so in order to protect him, Set goes with him and fends off all the monsters while he's unconscious. Wow. So he's kind of the defender of the god. And so Set has some good characteristics too. And he defends his followers as well. There is another kind of version of how Horus and Set square off. It's a little less exciting, but there's like this council of elder gods, and it's this sort of courtroom drama. And so they
Egyptian law and order
cases, dun, dun. And they have to perform these little trials. One of the trials, they both have to take the form of a hippopotamus and go under the river, you know, get into the Nile and be underwater for 3 months.
Oh my gosh.
Without coming out. So while he's, you know, in this state, he relies on his mother, Isis, to go and kill Set while he's vulnerable. So Isis goes to try and kill Set, but she can't kill her brother. She takes pity on him. And after the challenge is over, Horus gets real pissed off at his mom and beheads her.
Oh, my God.
Don't worry. That's she comes it. Back.
Sure. Yeah. Everyone comes back.
Yeah. I think she gets a cow head or something and she comes back as, cow god something.
Wow.
Yeah.
When they fight, they take it for real. There's no like gentle wounds.
But you're right. You know, no purely good, no purely evil. But I think you hit it on the head that, Set comes the closest to the evil god.
Yeah.
You mentioned that this kind of sets up the divine origins of the Egyptian pharaoh. I've got an excerpt here. Emily, if you wouldn't mind reading. This is the Great Daily Courses or greatcoursesdaily.com. So I don't know how credible this is, but it sounded interesting and it kind of lined up with the other things that I read. So
do you know who the writer is of it?
I don't, but I do have the link in the show notes.
Okay, awesome. Just to make sure we give proper credit.
Yep.
Okay, so here's the excerpt. The story of the death of Osiris and the contest between Horus and Seth for kingship has a complicated web of connections and meaning relevant to royal rule in Egypt. At death, a pharaoh assumes the role of Osiris, the dead king, king of the underworld. He retains his royal identity as he departs into the underworld, and just as Osiris did, he leaves behind his heir, the new pharaoh who assumes the throne and the royal identity as Horus did. In this way, the continuity of the rule of the eternal divine pharaoh is maintained because as soon as an individual pharaoh dies, he is no longer the divine pharaoh, but is now identified with Osiris instead of Horus, and the new pharaoh assumes the role of Horus as the divine pharaoh. The story also validates the legitimacy of the reigning pharaoh's authority. The contest between Horus and Seth for supremacy sometimes is understood as a contest between Lower Egypt, which was associated with Horus, and Upper Egypt, which was associated with Seth. But on a more primary level, the contest is between order and disorder, between the virtues of autocratic kingly authority and the threat of social chaos.
Yeah. So previously you had mentioned the god Isfet, which was the god of chaos or the absence of order.
Yes. Absence of order.
Isfet, the physical manifestation of Isfet is Set.
Okay. A physical manifestation. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. That answers that question. Because I was wondering about that.
Yeah, Set is the god of storms and chaos and, you know,
sure. That kind of
stuff. Not okay. Primal chaos, not like primordial chaos, but like disorder.
Yeah, but a little bit more extreme and more than just trickster, right? Yeah. Like actual, like owns the void there.
Yeah, he's kind of in between trickster and devil, right?
Yeah.
Very interesting deity. And that brings us to the end.
That's pretty great. Emily, is your mind blown or do you have things you want to add to it from your crazy amounts of Egyptian research?
Well, I mean, not crazy amounts. That's just my little period of documentary watching. I always thought that Isfet, I think it's Isfet, was considered the god of chaos, was the opposite of Maat. I don't know how to pronounce it. I'm sorry. And therefore was like the first god of evil. And just one thing that I remember was that the beginnings of everything was chaotic. That was kind of the natural state. And then order arrived in the form of Maat. So the absence of Maat was just Isfet. was that chaos. Mm-hmm. Just kind of like I was mentioning to you earlier, the absence of heat is cold. That's all cold is. Cold is just the absence of heat. Isfet is just the absence of order. Mm-hmm. And order was considered good and chaos was considered bad. And so you have that, it's the dualism, that duality.
Yeah.
So I was thinking that this podcast episode was going to be about Isfet.
Yeah.
And so I'm surprised because I learned a bunch of stuff that I didn't know and that I didn't realize. So,
yeah.
So this was really cool. And being able to tie it in with the stories from the Bible that I know, for me personally, the Bible has stories in it that are not necessarily historically accurate. They are stories that are used to teach and they spring from real world events. And I'm always curious to see what the real world events were. Absolutely. That informed these stories, that inspired these stories. So it's fun to kind of get into this and see similarities between Christianity and ancient Egyptian religions. So yeah, this was fantastic.
All right. Well, you know, Egypt obviously have some undeniable influences on the Western concept of the devil, but yet there's still no specific designated devil, you know, in Egyptian religion.
Right.
Set comes close, real close. The color red, the notion of red-haired people associated with the evil god, the trickster, the ever locked in battle with the sky god. You know, in Egypt, the cosmos has a divine order, the Maat, a rightness and a balance to it. And that obviously comes from their observations of their surroundings, that they observed the right order of things when the flood comes in and they're able to, you know, farm and the sun rises and sets and so on. So at its resting state, the universe is okay. It's at peace. It has sort of a divine purpose and ordination. And evil is the disruption of that order, you know, or chaos, as you said. Yeah. So, but I think it's really interesting that at the universe's resting state, there is order and there is a balance. And sort of everything's the way it should be. Up north, in Mesopotamia, the state of the universe could not be more polar opposite than Egypt.
Really?
In the next episode, we're going to explore the Sumerians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and the Canaanites, and their gonzo myths that clearly influenced how we got to the concept of the devil today.
Oh, cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Gonzo myths. That's fun.
I love it.
Yeah, you're going to love this.
Oh, yes.
Also, if you have seen the Marvel movie, The Eternals, some of those names are going to sound familiar in this, you know, next episode.
Sweet.
Also, if you play D&D, some of those names will be familiar.
That's why I know the name so well that I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Watched No Time to Die last night, so.
Nice.
I still need to do that. You beat me. Good job.
This has been The Devil You Don't Know. Head over to our new website at thedevilpodcast.com and leave a comment or review. We now have Devil merch on our site, so if you want to show your support, check that out. You can also find all the links to our social media. Do you have a story, a question, maybe praise for the show? Leave us a voicemail at 971-666-3351, and we may even play your voicemail on an episode. That's 971-666-3351. And don't forget to subscribe. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you, Emily. And we do have some shout outs for our Kickstarter backers. So today we're giving a shout out to Fred the Frog, Kathy Digby, Katie, KVH, Lambert from Scotland. Lambert! I always think of that. Lauren Hazel, CEO of Black Nerd Swag, Levi Furfer, Matt Vansel, Merc Werke, Moritz, Rob McLennan, Seth M. Davis, Stephanie Patton, Stephen Whitehead, Tech the Rogue, and the Rubin family. And thank you for listening. Tune in next time on The Ancient Origins of the Devil, Mesopotamia, and Canaan.
Bye.
Next on The Devil You Don't Know. Let's get into the Enuma Elish. This is the Babylonian creation epic. Jeremy, how you feeling?
I feel like if you said the word epic, then I should definitely be the one to read it.
All right.
That's
I'm just happy it's not me, because there's words in that. So I
there's a lot of words.
A lot of names. A
lot of names. Yes,
do it.
It's interesting.
I believe in you.
I love the way it's written. I'm just going to put that right out there, Donna. There's some direct verbiage. I got to make sure I don't screw up. Reading it the way it's written is a chef's kiss. That's the way it's done. Once they were separated and distinct, their union gave birth to the younger gods. These younger gods were a loud, rowdy bunch of asshole kids. They kept Apsu from sleeping at night and distracted him from doing his work during the day. So he gets super pissed off and finally can't stand it anymore and plots to murder all his kids. That is a real thing, by the way. All parents out there, you feel exactly what I'm talking about.
But then out of revenge, she seeks out Mott and kills the fucking shit out of him.
Holy shit.
yeah, don't have any descriptions about that one?
Yeah. Death, thou shalt die. And there's another myth about Anath, and she's confronted with a hostile army of men because. And she fights... reasons, who knows? She fights them violently and also slays the shit out of them.
The right way to say that, stark similarities. They're very similar.
One very clear, yeah.